So my understanding is that we're going to sit in the beginning. I like to parse this out. Everybody wants to do metta practice? Raise their hand. Everybody who wants to do vipassana practice, raise their hand. Vipassana is winning. I don't know why vipassana always wins. Let me ask you this. Who here has a mind that is never harsh, never judgmental, never critical of yourself? So you probably should have been raising your hand for metta practice because that will resolve that. You already voted. I want to do what you want so that you feel comfortable in your practice. Do you want a silent meditation or do you want a guided meditation? Silent meditation, no guiding. And then guided meditation. So guided meditation wins. I'm going to do a guided meditation, which is one of the talk that I've been asked to give is around addiction and meditation interventions for the addiction process. And what I want to then do is offer a guided meditation, which is part of that curriculum. And this meditation is focused on paying attention to your thoughts and to notice whether the thought that you're thinking is a single thought or that the thought that you're thinking is a perseverating or repeating thought. You know what I mean by that? Addiction is really a system of emotional regulation. And so we need to begin to be able to sensitize ourselves to the experience of emotional regulation. And most of the time, regulation in humans is done by activity or by thinking. And so in meditation practice, paying attention to your thought process is a really useful way of beginning to examine the process that leads to addiction. In meditation interventions, we look at four modules around relapse or conduits for relapse. The way that meditation interventions program is structured is based on the research of Alan Marlatt from the University of Washington on the main conduits for relapse, which are basically around the way that you think. I tend to organize them in four modules around particular meditation practices so that you can develop the practice that will illustrate for you the thought processes that tend to lead you in the direction of relapse so that you can know whether your thinking process is heading you toward relapse or is heading you toward continued abstinence or harm reduction on substances or behaviors. I don't really make a distinction between substances and behaviors because they're all intended to be ways of emotionally regulating yourself. In particular, the thought processes around using tend to lead to relapse. What you may know, if you're familiar with these kinds of dialogues, the Dan Siegel model of the emotional tolerance. So there's a window of emotional intensity that you can just tolerate. If something happens and it falls in that window of intensity, it just rolls through and you don't need to do anything about it. But if something happens and the emotional reaction to it is intense enough, you have an emotional event that needs to be regulated and you will have already established in you strategies for regulating that kind of emotional disturbance that are thinking-based. And you will have learned these in childhood from the family system that you grew up in. If you grew up in my family system and something frightened you, the mind would immediately generate anger or sadness, depending on what it was. If you something angered you, the mind would tend to generate sadness. And so you can begin to recognize these patterns. Because there's an underlying cause of the thought for using, which is intended to be regulating, if you had a long history of addiction, the mind is going to easily think of using because you've developed a system of regulating your emotions by using substances or behaviors. If you notice that you're just going through your day and all of a sudden you have the thought of using, what's actually happening is there's an emotional experience in the present moment which is too intense for you to tolerate, and the mind is thinking of a way to regulate it. The mind tends to perseverate over this thought because that drives the strong emotion. Why, might you ask, is something emotionally regulating, like generating a lot of anger, emotionally regulating over a little bit of sadness in the present moment? Because emotion that's self-generated and emotion that's reactive to the present moment plays out in the same area of the body. So face, front of the throat, front of the torso, inside of the arms here, and inside of the legs here is where you typically experience the physical activity of emotion in the body. If you have a reaction to the present moment, that's where it's playing. And if you think a thought that generates intense emotion, it plays in the same arena. So the thought process displaces awareness of the present moment. You may notice that these thought patterns take you into the future or take you into the past, but really what they're doing is taking you out of the experience of the present moment so you don't have to tolerate the intensity of emotion that you're experiencing. If you don't pay attention to the flow of thinking, then you can get caught up in these perseverating loops that drive intense emotion. The reason why this is problematic if you're thinking about using is that the underlying stressor that caused that emotional upwelling is not being attended to while you're in the fantasy of using. And if you don't attend to the conditions of the present moment, they tend to escalate the intensity of them, which means you have to ramp up the intensity of the fantasy to mask the experience of the present moment. And you can get to the point where distress is so great that your cognitive ability to distinguish between a self-generated fantasy that is relieving the distress of the moment and an actual plan of action. And then you may find yourself spontaneously using without any intention to use. Is that making sense as a description? So one of the main conduits to relapse is allowing yourself to fantasize about using in the future or remembering with deliciousness the using of the past. Is that making sense? Nobody ever really likes to remember the cruddy part of using, but we do tend to preserve these myths of how great it was or how great the relief might be. So you want to develop this distinction between one-off thoughts and perseverating thoughts. So the meditation that I'm going to describe for you is simply paying attention to auditory thinking space and noting whether the thought is a one-off thought or the thought is a repeating thought. Is that a pretty simple instruction? This is a Vipassana practice because we're examining the sensing experience. So it's a sensing experience of auditory thinking. Most people hear auditory thinking inside the head or at the opening of the ears. Auditory thinking space tends to be a soft place. It's sort of an area rather than a pinpoint. So when you're looking for the auditory thinking space, just sort of locate your attention in an area. One of the difficulties about working with auditory thinking space is that the content of thought tends to be really sticky and you can get pulled into thinking pretty quickly. If that happens, just give yourself a break. Auditory thinking space is really sticky, and so it's easy to get pulled into the content of thought. As soon as you recognize that that's what's happened, just bring yourself back. I like to use a noting strategy for doing this because it helps not get caught up into the content of thinking. You really want to pay attention to the content of thought only enough to determine whether it's a one-off thought or the thought itself is repeating. Anybody here familiar with storylines that tend to repeat in their mind? So you know what I'm talking about. Something happens in the present moment, there's a thought reaction, and it arises and passes, and then something else happens, and then there's a thought reaction, and it arises and passes. This is the normal flow of sensing experience. It's when we're needing to regulate something that the mind gets hung up on a particular narrative or storyline. I used to live in New York City. I had a loft on 11th and Broadway, which I loved living in, which I was forced out of. and one of my favorite anger stories is around being pushed out of my loft in 1983, where I maintain I would still be living if they bastards hadn't pushed me out. I was paying $174 a month. Four years ago when I was here, it was available for rent for $8,500. What do you people have to do to live here? All right. You all know noting practice? And noting practice is where you know where your attention is, and then you soak into the sensing experience of it, and then you can generate a label that corresponds to where your attention is. In this meditation, it's a restricted meditation, so we're only focusing on auditory thinking space. So all other sensory experience is not included in this meditation. You just want to let it be in the background. Simply focusing on the space in the head or the opening of the ears where you hear mental talk. It may be that in bringing your attention to this space, your otherwise continuously chatty mind goes completely radio silent, which is just fine. Enjoy the peace and quiet. Know that if you bring your attention there, you can find peace and quiet. Eventually, though, the mind will relax and allow the thought processes to begin to flow. And then you're going to evaluate whether they're a one-off thought or a repeating thought. Is that instruction pretty clear? In a noting and labeling practice, you're simply generating notes and labels in an ongoing basis. I tend to prefer the rhythmic noting strategy. So at the end of every out-breath, whatever's going on in auditory thinking space, at that moment I'll note it. But you could also use a freely moving strategy where you're simply waiting for the activation, and when the activation happens, then you note whether it's a one-off thought or a repeating thought. The upside of the rhythmic noting strategy is you tend to get caught up in thinking for shorter periods of time, because when you get caught up in thinking, you stop generating the label and you have that immediate feedback that you've lost the technique and you can come back. But it tends to be harder to concentrate with the rhythmic noting. With the freely moving strategy, it's easier to concentrate, but you can get caught up in thinking for much longer periods of time before you recognize that that's what's happened. So the upside is an easier concentration, but a longer lapse, and the other side is a harder concentration and a shorter lapse. There is no preferred way. This is really what you find to be the most helpful to you. Is that making sense? So you're just hanging out. Oh, was there? So you generate an internal metronome of some kind, and every time it clicks, you make a note and label where your attention is in that moment. So I like to note at the end of the out-breath, because the breath is a very reliable metronome. So every time I reach the end of the out-breath, I label where my attention is. Some people might argue that that's a divided attention, but I really have almost all of my awareness on the object of meditation rather than dividing between the breath and the object. A lot of people are trained to anchor into the breath, and this is a good way to bridge into the just noting practice. three labels: rest, one-off, repeating. It's useful to use short labels when you're doing this so that you're paying attention. If the mind is quiet, just note rest, rest. If you notice a thought arise and pass and it's not repeating, just use one-off or one. And then if you notice that the mind is perseverating, use the label repeating. What I think most people will find is if they use anger, they have a handful, maybe five or six themes that they use to generate anger. Maybe the details change a little bit, but the injustice themes tend to be consistent and identifiable. If you use sadness, you'll have a handful of stories that generate sadness. If you use fear, you'll have a few catastrophizing stories that you use. Some people use shame, some people use guilt. They're slightly different. Shame is kind of around the whole, your whole being. Guilt is around particular actions that you take. Everybody's a little bit different in this because it's based on actually your conditioning, not on a general schema of humanity. And most of these strategies for regulating your emotions you will have learned early in your family systems. So you'll do it the way that your family system does it. Sometimes it's useful to go home for the holidays and watch how everybody regulates their emotions so that you can have insight into how you're doing it, because you're going to be doing it in the same way. And then as you go along in life, you may pick up other regulatory strategies that are beyond the family system based on intimate relationships that you may have had along the way.
What do you think about songs in the head? Not like, you know, getting a song and it not being able to leave you for a while.
I've been playing Donna Summers for 4 days. It's driving me mad. It's just another, so that would be labeled repeating. Yeah, because it's a perseverating thought. Now, here's an interesting something. Donna Summers plays, and I'm back in the disco mode, and it produces a very pleasant feeling in the body. So I'm self-generating a positive feeling experience to regulate emotion, which is not a bad thing, and I wouldn't recommend that you change it. It's totally a good way to do it. Very different than, say, a thought pattern that generates intense anger, which would be afflictive, and I would suggest that you stop doing that.
Sometimes the content of the song actually seems to be related to something that's going on.
Yeah.
Whatever the song is about.
Right. So this is content and function. So what we're really talking about maybe in this particular discussion is what's called mentalizing, to see what the mind is doing and to understand the function of it. So the song is triggered because it's in the pattern of memory, which is related to what's going on in the present moment. That's how memories are stored. But the function of the song playing in the mind is to be emotionally regulating. So there's these two aspects. This is what I'm thinking, this is why the body mind is doing it in this moment, these two aspects. So that's a development of mind, of mentalizing, which is really important in terms of not relapsing. I'm not thinking of using because I want to use, but I'm thinking of using because something is emotionally distressing me and I'm attempting to regulate the emotion by thinking of using. I need to emotionally regulate, I can't use, so I'm going to use a different strategy to emotionally regulate, would be the mentalizing aspect of experiencing the mind, thinking about using. Is that making sense? the mind thinks of using. The reason the mind is thinking of using is because the way that you regulate the experience of the present moment is associated with using, which means in the past you used when that thing happened, but you're aware that the consequences of using are so bad that you don't want to do that, and the situation of the present moment can be regulated in different ways, and so you use a different strategy to regulate the present moment rather than the thought of using or using. The danger with the thought of using is that if you don't handle the stressor of the present moment, have you noticed there's a correlation between the level of stress and your ability to think clearly? The higher the level of stress, the lower your ability to think clearly. You'll get to the point, if you allow the mind to think of using, where you can't tell the difference between a fantasy, self-soothing activity, and an actual plan of action, and then you will follow through on the thought of using. The thought of using will regulate the stressor of the present moment. Your cognitive ability will come back online and you'll go, oh my God, I've used again. This will dump a heap of guilt and shame or regret or whatever it is that happens to you when that happens, which is what? An intense emotional experience that tends to be in excess of what you can manage. And then you'll be back into the process of needing to regulate that. And if you think of regulating shame by using, the mind will then be thinking of using again. And you'll go from a single lapse into a process of lapsing until the overwhelming emotional burden of having started to use again just swamps your capacity to emotionally regulate without using, and you'll be back at it just as intensely as you were before you tried to stop last time, which we would call a relapse. So you have the lapse, and then the relapse. So,
Do you think that I really like how you're speaking, just the way you're trying to frame things, it's really great. When you say using, right, like using to feelings or emotions to regulate, could you say a little bit more about that? Because some of what I get from it is the using is there to not feel something deeper that's driving the system.
Right.
So, and I'm curious if you have anything to say about that.
That's it. I need to regulate this emotional event. I'm regulated by shooting dope. That thing happens. I think, I'll go shoot dope because that'll regulate this. And then you shoot dope. I was not a user of hypodermic needles. I like to be on the floor, unable to move, drifting toward unconsciousness. That was my regulated spot. And I did it through speed alcohol. My given cocktail would be speed, alcohol, cannabis, and poppers of some kind. Amyl or butyl. I was definitely a dopamine fiend, if you know what I mean. There's a few reward systems. Addictions are usually built around one of the reward systems. Dopamine is the up, 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 and the endorphins is the opioid or down, down, down. I was also, well, let's just say the sexual revolution was upon us, and tarting around town was a normal way of being. What else? I think I have them all except for gambling. I really don't get gambling. I think if I come to a time in my life where I have nothing else to do, I'll learn how to do it. But self-generated, emotional, fantasy-generating, self-soothing strategy. Is that all? You're pretty clear about what this investigation is? So we're using meditation to investigate the system of being, the way that we are in the world. That's really what this investigation is. I do think that the long game in meditation is classical enlightenment. But I think that a lot of us have conditions that prevent us from practicing in such a way or developing that kind of insight that needs to be addressed as we go along. And addiction is definitely one of those things that needs to be addressed. After we do the meditation, I'll talk more about the attachment basis of addiction, which I see really no conflict at all between the two, because attachment, conditioning, and the conditioning that we talk about in Buddhism are the same. The difference between them is that in the poetics of Buddhist conversation, the descriptions of what conditioning can lead to are more general. I like lots of instructions, and I like things to be really clear and precisely described. And so I sometimes find that the general descriptions in traditional Buddhism aren't specific enough for me. And the reason that attachment is so appealing to me is that it describes precisely how conditioning leads to these views. The first of the Eightfold Path is right view, to understand how what happens to you informs the way that you create the sense of self and world out of the sensing experience. You know, we're in this constant back and forth. This is the sensing experience. This is the thing that we've made out of the sensing experience. This is the sensing experience. This is the thing that we've made out of the sensing experience. And if we can pay attention to the mind states that dominate between the sensing and the thing that we make the sensing experience into, we can begin to see how we distort the perception of reality based on these conditioned responses. We sense, we go through this process of perception that creates out of this vibratory energy of being this solid sense of self and solid sense of world. And we need to be able to get in and see how we're creating this solidity out of the fluidity of the sensing experience. If we can begin to see how we're doing that, we can move into the place of actually seeing things the way that they are. And that's what this practice is really about. But if we're constantly derailed by our conditioning, we don't get to that place where we can do that. And so sometimes, particularly around addiction, we need to address the system that leads to that first. Any questions about the rather long-winded instruction for the meditation? So how long would you like to sit? 40 minutes. 45 minutes. 42. All right. Here we go.
I love big bells.
When we talk about addiction, I tend to talk about it as an attachment disturbance. I think of it as relational. Mostly, I describe it as a decision that you made if you use addictive strategies somewhere along the line that people were so unreliable that you were no longer willing to count on them. So the fundamental basis of addiction is this underlying belief that people are so unreliable that they'll always let you down, and that it's better that you figure out how to make it through the world on your own without having to rely on anybody. I think given the conditioning that most of us who have addictive issues face, this was a reasonable decision, a reasonable outcome to what actually happened to you when you were small. People were so unreliable that you couldn't count on them. And so you needed to learn how to make your way through the world without relying on them. But what we don't tend to notice along the way is that the conditions change and that it is possible to rely on some people. But the system that we develop for being in the world is so compelling that we don't make space for that. Or because of the accelerating addiction, the way that we show up makes us so unreliable, no one else will count on us. And so we're in this bind of unreliability. The reason that I bring this up at the top of a talk about addiction is because I really want to ardently urge you to change your mind about this. There are people who will show up for you reliably, and you can train yourself, if you're not yet capable of it, to show up reliably for other people. But you'll need to do both of these things. When we look at attachment, everybody somewhat familiar with attachment, or should I give you a brief? I'm just seeing blankness, so I'll give you a brief. After the Second World War, you may, you know, my childhood was so dominated with the Second World War that I think it's a ubiquitous understanding of things. But culturally, if you were born after 1985, you know, you're just thinking about something else altogether. During the Second World War, Germany bombed England, particularly London, and the poor children were taken out of London during what they called the Blitz and put into foster care in the countryside to preserve the generation. The British government wanted to know if the separation from the caregivers produced lasting harm that they would end up having to provide services for so that they could budget for the services. This is the origin of attachment theory. They hired a guy named John Bowlby to do the research, and what he discovered was the separation between caregiver and child caused lifelong harm. And this was news. This was big news. Prior to that, the prevailing Western psychology idea was not that it was what actually happened to you that mattered so much as how you internally dealt with it. And here the evidence was emphatically the thing that happened to you is actually the thing that causes the effect. This fits very well with Buddhism, cause and effect. Things happen and there's an outcome to them. They then did research to see whether there was a particular pattern of outcome that could be traced back to behaviors on the part of the caregiver, and they identified three distinct patterns of attachment in children: secure, anxious, avoidant, and anxious, ambivalent. And then they sent teams into the homes of children that they identified like this, and they did very detailed studies of what the interaction between caregiver and child was that produced the particular pattern of behavior that was so recognizable. They did what's called a strange situation examination of mother and child. At that time, it was all mother and child dyads. And they could begin to tell at 10 months old what the attachment strategy of the child was. And as they later tested it, they discovered that the attachment strategy of a 10-month-old was very durable, that you have a 70% chance of finishing your life with the same attachment strategy that you had at 10 months. This is a very high number. Something major has to happen to shift it, or some major intention to shift it needs to happen. Mary Main and Eric Hesse, who are up at Berkeley, I'm pointing because I think I'm in LA. It's on the other side of the river, don't worry about it. Discovered that there was an additional attachment strategy which they called disorganized in children and fearful in adults. In addiction research, what they've discovered is that there's two clusters of attachment strategies which tend to have a high level of addiction. So if you're fearfully attached, you have a 70% chance of being addicted. If you're a dismissing adult or an avoidant child, you have a 30%, where 30% of dismissing people are addicted to substances and 70% of fearful people are addicted to substances. And then the research on the behaviors is not really complete to know. And that the other attachment groups don't tend to head into substance addiction. So it's really avoidant people that tend toward addiction. You're avoiding intimacy, avoiding contact with other people. And this comes from your hard-earned experience that they're unreliable. And in the case of fearful people, they're dangerous. And so what we begin to do when we have that view, that belief about ourselves and the world, is we begin to look for ways to emotionally regulate ourselves that don't require us to rely on other people. We're herd animals. We live in complex social systems, and the dominant way in which we emotionally regulate is by co-regulating with someone else. So I talked earlier about this window of emotional intensity that you can just tolerate. If something happens in that window, then you just tolerate it. But if something happens and the emotional response exceeds that tolerance, you have an emotional event that needs to be regulated. And as a child, you would have turned to your caregiver and they would have helped you regulate that emotional experience. But if you grew up in a household where you didn't have reliable caregivers, that process of learning to emotionally co-regulate with other human beings doesn't happen very well. And so you don't learn to naturally turn toward other people to help you regulate. You turn to external things that will help you regulate. And as soon as you're old enough, you discover that there are these substances that can be emotionally regulating, and then you develop a way of being in the world that allows you access to them. This is the process of addiction. The better you are at getting these substances and behaviors to regulate you, the less you rely on people to emotionally regulate you. So part of this is going to be a process of learning to emotionally regulate yourself, but at the same time understanding that it's very unlikely that you will be able to maintain emotional equilibrium, and it's vital to have people who will help you emotionally regulate when you need them. All you have to do to have reliable people available to you to emotionally regulate you is you are reliably available to them when they need you to emotionally regulate. So it's a mutual experience. Secure relationships are built on this foundation of reliability. Fearful people are terribly unreliable in terms of showing up. Dismissing people tend to be pretty good at showing up. So this is something to consider. Mutual relationships, reliable relationships, are the ground on which secure relationships grow. The first quality of a feeling sense of being in relationship to someone else that comes from this reliability and this mutual care is a sense of safety, a felt sense of safety. This is something that addicts almost never know except when they're just getting high. Do you know that feeling of that relief that comes from using? that felt sense of safety. What we need to begin to do is to develop that in other people so that in connecting to other people, we have a felt sense of safety that arises. Do you know what to attune is? So you can tell that we're attuned, right? And everyone else can tell that we're attuned and I'm not attuned to them. And now I've changed my attunement. Oops, everybody can track that. We're highly sensitive to this attunement. With attunement comes this emotional response. If you feel safe, you're willing to attune to somebody and you're willing to reveal authentically who you are. And if you don't feel safe, you're not willing to attune and you don't want to reveal who you are because you feel that you could be threatened or hurt by that. Attunement in human beings is at different degrees. So in the back there, it's probably pretty easy to attune to me because you can sort of connect to my face and the eyeballs, but you can't see me close enough to read any micro expressions or any emotional content really in the face. It's a general experience. This close, a little bit closer, maybe 3 feet, you can read easily the emotional micro expressions in a face. You know, that flashing of emotion that happens as you're talking to somebody. And that creates a much more difficult internal experience to regulate. And then at this close, you can read the subtle fluctuations of the iris, which is something that you can't really mask. A lot of us, particularly in urban environments, have learned to suppress or regulate the facial expressions of our emotions, but you can't really do that with the irises. And so who do you let this close to you? Who do you let see you unmasked? We tend to be very restrictive about who we let get that close to us, who we let see us as we are in an unfiltered way. But if you felt safe with somebody, you would be willing to allow them to see you, see who you are. And in that sense of being seen by somebody, the possibility of emotional co-regulation begins to happen. This is an empathetic process. The first level of empathy is this visceral response to witnessing someone else's physical or emotional pain. You kind of whinge with it. The second level is where you look at somebody and you can read their facial expressions and body language and know how that represents their internal experience. And the third level of empathy in Buddhism we would call compassion or compassionate empathy is where you actually feel their emotional experience in your body. Compassion in the Buddhist sense is narrowly restricted to an awareness of somebody else's suffering and a willingness to be in an empathetic connection to them while they're suffering. And what we're really pointing to in this practice is emotionally co-regulating someone else. Or someone else emotionally co-regulating you. You allow the empathetic connection with someone else. And if they're in distress, you bring your emotional regulation skills to their experience and it's fed back to them through the empathetic process and helps them come back into emotional balance. That's this process of soothing or co-regulating emotionally. Another aspect of the secure relationship is a felt sense of delight in seeing the other person. If you know that in seeing the person that they're safe, that you can be authentically yourself and that you'll be co-regulated by them, it tends to lead to this experience of delight in seeing them. If you have those qualities in the relationship, then it opens you up to the possibility of exploration. If you have somebody that you can turn to that will regulate you when you get dysregulated, then it frees you up to explore to the very edges of what's interesting to you, because if you get totally knocked sideways by the exploration, there is somebody reliable that you can come to that will help balance you so that you can go back out in the pursuit of things that are meaningful to you. If you restrict your exploration because the emotional dysregulation that comes from exploring is something that you can't handle yourself, you begin to curtail and limit the meaningfulness of your life. And as you may notice with addiction often, we make these very tiny lives that are very compact and are filled with despair. The despair that comes from not really going for the thing. We know, or we talk about a lot of this in Buddhism, everything is impermanent, so everything will be lost. There's no self that you need to protect or guard or preserve. The self is insubstantial, and it arises and passes based on conditions. Everything is lost. Everything is impermanent. We grow old, we get sick, we die, we get what we want and we lose it, or we don't get what we want, or we have to put up with the things that we don't want. There's a subtle, constant irritation that nothing is exactly the way that you would have it, which is kind of a double-edged sword. It's not how you want it, and you actually don't have much power to make it the way that you want it. This is the conditions. This is how it is. If you want to explore at the far edges of what's meaningful to you, you have to go in wide-eyed knowing that if you get it, you're going to lose it. So that we don't restrict ourselves to prevent that sadness of loss. One of the things about people who grow up to pursue addiction as a way of emotionally regulating is that they're often overwhelmed by the burden of sadness already by the time they get to the place of wanting or needing or being able to explore for themselves what's meaningful. And so the touching into that terrible sadness is the thing that prevents them from exploring, or they engage in a kind of pseudo-exploration, things that have high social value but may not have any real resonance for what's meaningful specifically to you. This would be a dismissing person. And a fearful person usually is good at beginning the exploration, but they're so easily overwhelmed and they lack resilience, so they need to stop and withdraw to regulate. One of the things that you'll notice about herd animals and cultures, we tend to move in groups, we tend to pursue things in groups, and if you can't show up reliably for the group won't have you as a member, and so you get more and more isolated. In the 12-step rooms, they talk about isolation as being one of these fundamental things, but for fearful people, the main way that you learn to regulate as a child is by isolating yourself. And fearful people are very big on perseverating thoughts, the mind just constantly rolling on what to do, what to do, what to do, what to do. Fearful people are afraid that if they do the wrong thing that they'll be killed. I'm not kidding. They really feel that viscerally. And so they're very hesitant to do anything at all. It creates a perception of them as passive, but they're not passive. Their mind is spinning about what exactly the right thing to do is so that I don't get killed by doing it. And we need to begin to change our mind about that. If you have somebody who you feel safe with, they're not going to kill you if you make a mistake. Right? What happens to you when you're a kid? So you're born, right? And you lay there. You can't even sit up. Do you know this? When you're an infant, you can't even sit up. You can't roll over. You're entirely dependent on someone to come and get you and take care of you. We're, if we were to compare ourselves to the great ape, we're born 18 months premature based on what their capacity is at birth. We can't do anything except look damn cute. so that somebody will come and take care of us. But what do you do if they don't show up? You look confused. Wait a minute, this isn't... I'm looking really cute now. You're supposed to come and take care of me. And then you cry intermittently, and then you cry out, and then you cry continuously. You go into tantrum mode. What happens if nobody comes and you're in full-blown tantrum mode? You shut down. You give up. So this is the experience of the dismissing adult as a child. They give up. Isn't that they give up on their needs? They give up on relying on anybody, and they give up on asking, and they begin a process of learning how to take what they want. And they don't understand mutual, and they don't understand reciprocal, because that wasn't their experience. They didn't learn it from anybody. And I want to create this window of compassion for ourselves and also for other people, in that this was actually the experience that we had, if that's how we ended up. You don't get that way otherwise. If you were a baby and you looked cute and somebody came and they figured out what you needed and they did their very best to give it to you, and they did that reliably enough, you begin to count on them. You think, I'm damn cute. Somebody comes and takes care of me. I'm capable. And the world is a place where my needs will be met by me simply asking. What's it like to wander through the world with that working model of self and world, right? That's what happens. But if nobody comes and they don't come consistently, you develop a sense of yourself as completely defective and the world as indifferent to you, which is unbearable for a child. And typically in those households, one of the elements that's required of the child is that they idealize the caregiver for being a good parent. And so you develop this capacity to idealize things. So everything's terrific, everything's great, everything's wonderful. I'm the greatest human being since sliced bread. And frankly, the rest of you suck. But I mean, I would have a mutual relationship with you if you were able to meet my needs, but since you're clearly not, I'm just going to take from you what I want. And if you're not willing to put up with that, other people are available. That's kind of the dismissing view that comes from that failure. If your parents or your caregivers, whoever it was, came sometimes, but not other times. Sometimes they got it right, sometimes they didn't get it right. It creates this tendency to become hyper-focused on their mind state, and you lose awareness of your own mind state. It's called preoccupation in preoccupied adults. In the addiction world, tend to be more in the Al-Anon side of things rather than on the active addiction side. They become so focused on the other person, and they tend to try and trade their essential care as a way of being in relationship. They seek proximity to their caregiver because if they're not, because they become so focused on the empathetic experience of the other person that when they're not with them, they feel disconnected and empty. They need nearly constant proximity to the person. And they need to be important so that the other person won't leave them, so they don't tend to get into substance addiction as much because that makes them too unreliable and they aren't able to maintain the connection that they want. I should point out that these are all organized strategies and people who have them do just about as well as other people, and it's not pathological. You don't need to get a self-help book to fix it. It's just your conditioning. And what we want to do in this practice of meditation is learn what we do so we can be good at operating the system that we have. One of the things about human beings is that we are born with brains that are not very well developed, and they develop in relationship to the environment that you have. And so if you have a dismissing brain, it means you have a deactivating brain, and that's the brain you have, and you're not going to be able to do much about the basic equipment that you have. What you're going to be able to do is update the software and learn new skills to manage it, but in terms of changing it entirely into something else, probably not. If you have a preoccupying mind, you have a hyperactivating mind, so hyper-alertness, hyper-vigilance toward other people, and that's the brain you have, and that's what you're likely to have. You're just going to learn how to operate it better. Is that making sense? As your brain develops, your amygdala, which is the sympathetic nervous system, activates when it sees something that might be dangerous, and then it communicates through the orbital frontal cortex with the hippocampus, which is supposed to evaluate whether the threat is real or not. And depending on that evaluation, it sends an impulse to the corpus callosum, which then regulates the amygdala down or up. And that's the process that you have. So that's the parasympathetic system, which is regulating down. Up and down, always perceiving the threats or the warmth that's there for us. But if you didn't have an environment where those linkages grew very well, then you don't have them. And so in dismissing people, you have a tendency to have a hyperactivating, or not, that's a bad word. You tend to have a dominant strategy of deactivating or parasympathetic response. You tend to suppress all awareness of emotion, which means you also suppress empathy. And so you're dismissing people aren't particularly empathetic. If you're preoccupied, you tend to have a hyperactivating mind. So the amygdala goes off, but it's not regulated by the hippocampus or the parasympathetic nervous system, so the mind hyperactivates. And then you're up, up, up for long periods of time. Fearful people tend to be on the other side of the trauma line. So we're not talking about ordinary conditions of childhood. We're talking about abuse or trauma that happens to people that develop a fearful strategy. 70% of people in the fearful category have substance addiction, so it's a little bit out there. This is something that needs to be addressed. 30% of dismissing people have substance addiction, so that extreme isolation that comes from the avoidancy is so painful that it's difficult to manage without the very strong nature of painkillers that substances typically represent. The joy of the fearful mind is that you are both deactivating and hyperactivating, and sometimes both at the same time. So you can be dismissing and unempathetic, and you can be hyper alert to the mind states of other people, and you can have both of those active at the same time. Is that making sense? One of the things that we want to begin to do is to, through meditation primarily, and also through being in relationship to other people, begin to examine how we operate in the world so that we can begin to develop the skills that are necessary to improve the capacity for our own exploration of what's meaningful. If you're dismissing, you need to learn to recognize that you've dismissed or devalued or shut down so that your behavior isn't informed by that distortion of you. Remember, I was talking about this dance between the ultimate reality and the conceptual reality, which is this instruction in Vipassana. This is the ultimate reality or the sensing experience. This is what I've made it into. In this dance back and forth, you can begin to recognize that you have a dismissing attachment strategy, and that when the dismissing mind is present, it creates a distortion in the perceptual reality, which you could interpret in the moment is that the relationship that I'm about to destroy doesn't mean anything to me. what happens to dismissing people as they tend to devalue and annihilate the relationships that they're in. And then when the dismissing mind reactivates and they can see that actually they did value the relation, they attempt to repair them. Sometimes they're repairable. But if the repetition of this devaluing and destruction goes on for too long, the other person will give up on them, or they'll be confined to people that will put up with that kind of intense anger experience. Secure people don't. They don't. They just move on because to them, they're capable and the world is filled with people who will take care of them. Why would they bother with somebody who just blasts them with anger? So they don't. Fearful people, and I mainly like to talk about fearful people when I'm talking about addiction because it is the most common outcome, become frightened about what to do and withdraw, so they tend to be passive. And so whereas the repair for the dismissing person is to learn how to activate, the main repair for fearful people is learning how to show up reliably. And that means if you make a commitment to someone, you actually show up for them. If you fix that, there's a kind of sweetness in fearful people that is of high value socially in the adult world, that people will welcome you in. And you can even have relationships with secure people if you can fix the reliability piece. But the basis of secure relationships is reliability, and if you don't have that ticket, you can't even get on the ride. Is that making sense? So that reliability piece is the thing to begin to fix. Now you need to this is all, a lot of this is about emotional regulation. You want to be brilliant at regulating your own emotion, and at the same time you want to really understand that in order to explore and really get out into the world, into what's meaningful to you, you're going to be knocked sideways and you're not going to be able to regulate yourself, and you're going to need to have someone available to you to help you regulate so that you can come back into balance. That's the main reason why fearful people do so much less well than everyone else. They don't have anyone really that they're willing to regulate with, and so they don't. They can't risk exploring. Is that making sense? So one of the things that's important about beginning to understand how you are, and I do really want to emphasize that there's no blame in this, right? What could you have done? I was up at the attachment conference at Harvard last fall, and the new research on infants is showing that the first activation in the section of the brain that represents attachment activity materializes between 2 and 5 months old. What could you have done at 2 months old to get your care to be better? Mom, Dad? I'm examining the quality of care that you're presenting to me, and I'm realizing that it's going to badly affect my attachment development. Can you step your game up, please? Maybe at 6 months, you said, wait a minute, or at 18 months, or at 3 years. By the time you're 3 years old, the attachment process is pretty much set, unless something major happens or you do something to change it. It's totally changeable. You can move to secure relationships. But if you don't, you're going to live your life the way that it is now. And how's it going? So, understanding the way that you are, and understanding also that you're not to blame for this, right? The attachment stuff ends at about 3, and then what begins to happen is your actual relationship history than how well you lucked out meeting people who thought you were terrific and wanted to be friends with you, or didn't. We're highly sensitive to social hierarchy. Everybody who walked in here took a look around, evaluated their relative social position, and pegged themselves where they were. When you went out on the playground in first grade and you looked around and you saw which was the cool group or the smart group or the athletic group or whichever group that you wanted to be a part of, and you offered yourself to them, how did they respond to you? Did you get to be in the social group that you wanted to be in, or did you have to settle for a group that you had evaluated as less valuable? And then how did that affect your experience of yourself? I can't be in the group that I want to be in because they won't let me in. There's something wrong with me. Or I get to be in the group that I want to be in. That relationship history begins, and it informs the way that we act. If you walk into a room and you're used to being engaged with the people that you want to be engaged with, that you have high value for, you tend to just walk up to them and approach them and begin a conversation with them. But if you think that they're going to be rejecting, you're going to be quite a bit different in the way that you approach them. Maybe you don't even try. You think that it's hopeless at this point, and you just accept a group that you've evaluated as less valuable. That's what we all do. And so our exploration is to go and be accepted or rejected, not based on our conditioning, inhibit our exploration, so we're not even engaging in this. If we don't engage in it, our life has less meaning to us. You wake up in despair because the activities that you're engaged in aren't the ones that you want to be doing. Or do you get up and go into the activities that have real meaning to you because you've been able to set it up so that that's what you do, that's what you get to do. And this is this conditioning thing that we're talking about that comes so early, that relationship history, and how well a lot of that has to do with, I think, luck, or maybe karma is a better word for that. But it's totally informed by your attachment. If you're fearful, you're afraid to be authentic and express yourself, so you don't reveal yourself to the people that you want to, so they don't know that that's who you want to be with, and so they don't let you come. Is that making sense? We're running out of time, and I wanted to leave a short window for questions. Does anybody? I can, as you may gather, talk about this for hours. Preoccupied.
Kind of in a caught space. So having a self and then connecting to another without needing to have the other to have yourself. Now, that's more in a healthy adult place, but kid, the child needs the other to have a self. And what you're talking about are all those varying disturbances of relationship that happen that get carried into all these patterns, right? So if you become dependent on the other to try to regulate yourself, that's another trap.
Well, you want to be brilliant at regulating yourself, and at the same time understand that if you really go into exploration, you're not going to be able to do it all the time. And then you want to have some people around that are reliable at co-regulating that you can turn to in that moment, but that they won't restrict your exploration. And that you won't restrict your exploration because you can't regulate without them. Anybody else? Nope.
I've been sitting here fascinated because I'm thinking about some of the people I know, but most of all, the avoidant or the dismissive, you have described almost everybody in my family.
Right.
And this is the question I have. I grew up as an only child. My mother was an only child, so her side of the family was like non-existent. They don't exist at all anymore. My father had three brothers and sisters. They were all, I always viewed when we were around them, that they were not all there. I say this now as an adult, they never asked for help and they never gave it. My father was the black sheep amongst his brothers and sisters, the angry one, which I think might have saved him. Yet I grew up as a lonely kid. You're describing somebody who should have been very dismissive of others. But I figured out. I must have figured out how to change it when I was six, because I decided that I wanted to be part of these groups, and I thought, no one's going to want me. And I really believed that there were the cool kids who had the wise answers, and I wasn't one. So I figured out the way to have a life where I could be with people was to have talents. So at six, I put on shows in the neighborhood. And I did that till I was 15, because I became the person who put on the shows. And then I was the person who was in the shows. I was always in shows and plays, whatever. So that gave me the conduit to connect to other people in a familiar way. But I always, my whole life, have needed that structure, because going out and looking for it alone is excruciatingly painful.
Right. So the sense of delight that you would have experienced as a child from simply being a child, you only got because you did something.
Always had to do something.
Right. And that's different. Different than the delight that I was talking about.
And what I want to add is that after Christmas this year, because again, I did everything to bring people to my house, to do it all, and I crashed. For the first time in my life, I totally crashed and became enormously depressed. Took on a lot of physiological symptoms that had no basis in real illness, only minor. Exhaustion, headaches, sinuses, you name it. All right? And I told my therapist, I don't want to have to do anything. The thought of having to go out there to find something was so excruciating, I started getting body pain. I'm very good at coming to places like this because I know there'll be people working in places like schools where I know there'll be.
So in some sense, the idea is then to pick people who you find delightful and you enjoy taking care of, and then seeing if they reciprocate. That's the idea. So that the relationships are mutual and reliable. So that you don't actually have to do, you don't have to perform to get their attention. Just the way you are is enough for them. That's the idea.
Yes. But I was an example of somebody who could have been avoidant but wasn't. I don't know how to explain it.
What you're describing could be avoidant behavior.
Yeah.
So one of the things about beginning to understand attachment, it isn't the behavior that's indicative of the attachment strategy, it's the intention or what you want to get out of it. Mm-hmm. That's the indicator of what the attachment strategy is. The outward behavior could appear to be the same across all of the attachment strategies, and it's really the internal underlying motivation that's indicative of what is attachment.
So, George, thank you. And just had a question. Could you just talk a little bit more, if people wanted to go deeper, how they could learn more about your work and opportunities to engage with Matcha Group, so
sure,
that before we leave tonight, you can talk more about that.
We're a little over time. I put some business cards out there that have my phone number on them if you want to call me up and talk about it. I teach classes. Some of them are available remotely. We do meditation interventions for the addiction process class, which is around stabilizing abstinence or harm reduction And then we have a series of the Meaningful Life intensives, which are around learning what attachment is, learning the meditation techniques for repairing attachment. We also go into the first stage is just really understanding what's happening in terms of attachment and meditation. The second level of training is organized around moving your relationships into secure dynamics, but not touching into the deep conditioning. It's easy, relatively speaking, to shift the dynamics of the relationships that you already have into more secure dynamics just by learning what the secure dynamics are and doing them. And then the deep conditioning is the automatic responses. So you might think of shifting your relationships into secure territory as manual, and then training yourself to just have the body-mind do it automatically, which is at the third level. We are organizing to do a training to repair the conditioning around relationships that you actually had. We often get into patterns of who we pick to be in relationship to. And so that fourth level of the training is around reorganizing who you pick to be in relationship to. And then the fifth level of the training is around the third system that's active in relationships, which is around conflict resolution. You've learned how to resolve conflicts in your family system, and other people have learned it in their system. And how do you negotiate between the two systems of conflict resolution so that you can have stable, secure relationships? But I have a retreat coming up. Retreats are a good way to dive into the practice. It's in Millerton, New York, in April. April 13th, I think, is the retreat. I do also retreats on the West Coast. Come to the Christmas retreat. It's warm.
I had two things. One was the tools. We talked about being more dependable and then seeing if people bring it back. I wanted to hear more about that, and I think you've given us places to hear more about that. Hearing about it is very much interesting, but I love the, every now and again there'd be a tool in there.
Okay.
Here, and I would thought that was very critical. Otherwise, it was like, it felt a little hopeless.
Oh.
And I've been sober a long time, so I know that, I mean, I go to, you know, I practice, and I think that they go together in a beautiful way. Which brings me to the second thing I want to bring. Anybody who's interested in following this process, we have something called Buddha and Bill W. that meets in this place once a month, the first Monday of every month. We've been doing it for years. And we talk about the process of the paths that are toward freedom, the 12 steps and the Eightfold Path and all the teachings that the Buddha talks about. He even calls suffering tanha, which is thirst. So it's a good place to come, and it's the first Monday of every month, and we're reorganizing it right now, so I can't tell you, but it's sitting, movement, lots of discussion, dyads, laughter. I had a friend who said, Buddhism's not funny enough, you guys don't laugh enough. I said, you should come to our meeting.
As opposed to just fuck you. Anyone else?
Thank you very much. That was wonderful. Very educational. Can you be two types at once?
If you're two types at once, it's likely that you're fearful, because that's the one that does both.
Okay. And fearful, can you do a little short from a bit again?
Typically speaking, fearful people are the loveliest, kindest people you're ever going to meet. They're just really unreliable. And so you just need to really show up consistently. That's the main repair. Then you have to be willing to express authentically who you are. The anger that fearful people express is typically around feeling unseen. But it's kind of like, I'm hiding in the corner completely invisible and I'm really furious that you can't see me, is the kind of experience. So. We're a little over time, so.
Thank you. This is very brief. I don't even want to approach it, really. But I'm so fearful of abandonment that I felt tonight probably depression is my drug of choice.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound familiar?
The first module, which we were talking about tonight, is craving and urge. The second one is stress, anger, and depression. One of the main outcomes of using afflictive, self-generated emotion is depression. And so it's a very typical kind of depression that addicts have, which is a cycling depression, which comes from allowing intense emotion to be generated for too long, and so the body-mind shuts down the limbic system to allow the body to resettle. Because we're biochemical, the way that we generate emotion is by dumping a lot of chemicals into the system, then the saturation can get so rich that it's actually capable of physically damaging the structure of the brain. And when you get close to that, the body mind shuts off the limbic system, which is the thing that drives the chemicals, until the liver can filter them out. It takes usually about 2 hours for that to happen. And so the allowing the afflictive self-generated emotion leads to depression. And if you regulate the self-generated emotion and move into more afflictive things, you'll come completely out of the depression cycle by doing that. So that's the second module of the meditation intervention.
I should have taken that.
I didn't talk about it, but you can get it, either by contacting us or the on the website. I have recordings of all of the classes that I teach in the cycle on the website, which you can get by going there. All right. Oh, you did? Okay. So thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here. We'll see you,
thank you.
Somewhere else on the path. Thanks.
And I just want to quickly thank you.